I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the back half, the New Statesman's Culture Podcast. I'm Tom.
And I'm Kate.
And we are here with a bumper episode in our new fortnightly incarnation. Today we are going to be talking about the show that everyone's literally killing each other to see in London's West End, Hamilton, the hip-hop musical about founding father Alexander Hamilton. And what else have we got, Kate?
We're going to be talking about the return of a very disgusting object to the City of London, which we went to see this morning. And we're also going to have a special guest, Ryan Gilby, our film critic from The New Statesman, to talk about Loveless, the Russian movie about a missing child.
But we need to wait for Ryan to pronounce the director's name, because neither of us
are
confident enough. The first name is Andre, and the surname begins with a Z. And has too many consonants.
Yeah, it's got lots of H's and Z's and G's and V's.
Yeah.
But Ryan will know exactly how to say that. And he'll also have something to say about the film. So last night we went to see Hamilton in Victoria, which, as hip hopers go, it's fair to say it beats R. Kelly's Trapped in the Closet by a country mile. Although I do love that, and that ran for 33 chapters on his own YouTube channel.
There was a period where I think this was the period where whenever we had friends over, me and Claire, after dinner, you'd always have a YouTubing session where you just show each other videos on YouTube. That was the time where I remember everyone watching In the Closet.
The epic tale of love and deceit, which he never managed to put on Broadway because he wasn't in the right place
at the
right
time. Did he want it on stage?
Oh yeah, it was a big conceit of a Broadway show. He was just ahead of the boat, you know?
He was,
whereas Lin-Manuel Miranda was in the right place at the right time to write Hamilton, which is, give us a brief update on what Hamilton is about, because it's extremely complicated.
Well, Alexander Hamilton, and I don't know, obviously we are quite ignorant. Well, I say we, I mean me.
Me too.
Possibly
me too.
You. I don't want to speak for you. But I suspect a lot of people who've been through British school history system won't know much about American history or the Revolutionary War or of Independence or the Founding Fathers. Alexander Hamilton was one of the Founding Fathers. His face is on the $10 bill. And the musical tells his story, which is one of the lesser told stories of the Founding Fathers. He was born on a Caribbean island in the 1750s. He was born out of wedlock. He was a bastard son of a Scottish father and a mother who was half British and half French. His father left, went off somewhere, found another wife. His mother died when he was very young. For most of his childhood, he was growing up an orphan, taken in by other family members. He became a clerk, very, very bright, very, very voracious reader. Eventually, there was this catastrophic event, a hurricane struck, and he wrote this incredible account of it, which various members of the community saw this and thought, wow, this guy is incredibly talented. And they passed a cup around and basically got together enough money to send him off to North America for his education. So that's where he ended up in New York. It was around the time that the War of Independence was starting in 1775. And he made his way up through the ranks, joined the revolutionaries, ended up working as an aide to George Washington. Then after the war, trained as a lawyer, set up the Bank of America, was instrumental in getting the constitution through, wrote, I think there's one bit in the musical where they talk about how many essays he wrote in support of the constitution. I think it was 51 essays.
In six months. What was the recurring line? Something like, why do you write like you're running out of time?
Why do you write like you're running out of time? So yeah, he's always got a quill, if not in his hand, somewhere near his hand, and then is killed aged around 50 in a duel with one of his political rivals. That's the sort of span that the musical takes as its blueprint. But it's got a kind of interesting gestation story because it was first glimpsed quite a long time ago, wasn't it?
It was so general, apparently musical genius, singer, composer, choreographer, musical theatre man, Lin-Manuel Miranda, who is New York born, took on holiday, as you would, Ron Chernow's biography of Alexander Hamilton.
I've seen this book. It's giant. It's an absolute doorstop.
So it says something about Lin that he would take that on holiday. I remember we did a summer book special and some of our novelist contributors claimed that they were reading some giant tomes on the beach.
I like the fact you're calling him Lin, by the way.
It just makes me associate him
with Alan Partridge's.
Do you know where that comes from? Lin. It's actually because our deputy, Helen Lewis, is a big fan of his, and she always just refers to him by his first name. I think it's like a hopeful,
right.
You know,
if
you're familiar enough, then one day you will meet this man. So he decided that this very long, complicated story was perfect for a stage musical. And it came about in a very organic way because he wrote a rap about Hamilton that he performed at the White House Evening of Poetry, Music and the Spoken Word on May the 12th, 2009. So Obama was in, everything was good, and it kind of went down quite well. And then he started sort of performing mixtapes, as he called it, which were just little fragments of this story, performing them around New York. And it sort of got a bit of traction that way. But it's interesting because I think one of the songs, My Shot, he claims to have taken a year to write. So there must have been an element of character identification here with the idea of someone that can sit down and write 51 different documents in 6 months.
Absolutely.
And someone who can write, you know, take one, you know, one a whole year to do one song. It's a weirdly literary kind of, I think your wife Claire referred to it as a kind of pro-literacy musical, being a great teacher as she is. And I just thought that's so interesting. You've got whole songs that are about, you know, writing oneself into the narrative or quibbling about one comma in a sentence and what it means. And on so many levels, it's so unlikely to work as a stage musical.
But this is one of the ways in which the rap form is so perfectly suited for it, isn't it? Because in terms of words per minute, you know, rap provides this kind of absolutely loquacious, it's sort of like verbal quickfire.
Dexterous intellectual medium.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is perfectly suited to a story that just twists and turns and that, you know, children at school presumably would have struggled to learn unless they had mnemonics and rhymes to do so. So, I mean, it's almost like something that you would have got mocked in a Victoria Wood sketch in the 80s. You know, what's the least sexy subject matter for a musical? But it sort of lives up to the idea that if you do something really, really, really well, you can get away with anything.
Absolutely. It seems, watching this, you kind of think, why isn't all history delivered in this format? But in the wrong hands, it could be absolutely disastrous. But clearly, Lin-Manuel Miranda has a innate feeling for hip hop. He obviously grew up on it. He's around our age. So, you know, he would have grown up on the same 90s hip hop that we would have been listening to. Helen wrote a piece about Hamilton late last year, and she mentioned his influences being Busta Rhymes, Biggie Smalls, Brandy, Destiny's Child. He knows how to write rap, which is kind of really hard to do well. And the average sort of English teacher trying to sort of tell the story of Henry VIII through a made up rap in the classroom probably would get it massively wrong.
There's literally a moment where one of the characters goes, the Reynolds papers. And they're referring to the affair that Hamilton had and the documents he had to provide to show that this money had been delivered to this blackmailer in a kind of above board way. But, you know, the suspension of belief when you're in the theatre there and you're so excited by the way the music sounds that you hear a line like that and you think, oh, goody, we're going to hear about the Reynolds papers, this thing that I've never heard of in my life. And probably most people in America haven't heard of either.
One thing that's extraordinary about it is there's almost no non-musical speech in it. So it's just song after song after song. Everything is couched within, everything is framed within raps, and most of it's rapping. And then there's a few kind of numbers which verge more on kind of traditional Broadway territory. But it's like the soundtrack is about 2.5 hours and the show's about 2 hours 35 or something. So
just about 30 seconds of speech. Yeah,
it's incredible to sustain that.
For me, it was the thing that really I was never that bothered about seeing it until we realised that we were going to be able to go. And then it's the sheer sophistication of the musical kind of palette that it pulls from.
Yeah,
it does feel like a whirlwind tour of 1990s and mid 2000s hip hop. You've got, like you were saying, Destiny's Child. You've got the Skylar sisters, three female characters, sisters who sing in this beautiful En Vogue-ish Destiny's Child type harmony.
Yeah,
then you've
amazing.
Got Constitution delivered in the form of a battle straight out of 8 Mile. It's kind of, there's a lot of Eminem in there as well. It's quite sort of, it's commercial hip hop, isn't it? And then we actually saw the guy who was playing his nemesis, Aaron Burr, who was the third vice president of the United States, and eventually, not to ruin the story, had a duel with him, was the understudy last night, a guy called Sisipho Mazibuko, who I just thought was the complete star of the thing, who had actually the R. Kelly soft R&B delivery, not a kind of great big chest-beating musical theatre performance at all.
And he's the linchpin of the show, isn't he? Because he's the sort of narrator, he introduces it. Hamilton, although Hamilton is the crux of the show and a fascinating character, but there's something weirdly appealing about Burr. And he's got this kind of, he is a striver as well, but he has this great song about when Hamilton and Jefferson cut a deal, a really significant deal in terms of, it's, can you explain what this is? It's
no, actually, no this, idea. Most this, of it was like that.
This
me.
Is,
just
this
no
is one of the slight problems I had with it is, although it was a brilliant method for explaining history, there is this point in the second half of the show where Hamilton is pitched against Thomas Jefferson, who's portrayed as this kind of like a Purple Rain era prince. He's kind of like comes
crushed
down in
velvet
this
jacket.
Crushed velvet jacket. He's from Virginia. He's just got back from France. He has this great song where he's just got back from France, and he's like,
What
did I miss? Yeah. and him and Hamilton are at loggerheads. And Hamilton has this much more kind of commercial urban entrepreneurship vision, and Jefferson is from the South, so it's a more agrarian concept of what the states should be and kind of defending the interests of the South. But I had to kind of go away and read up on that a little bit, because although it pitched them brilliantly in terms of like oppositional characters, it didn't really I thought it could have done a little bit more to explain where they were coming from politically. That's a long detour to say there's a great scene where they're cutting this really important deal over dinner, and Aaron Burr has this song about wanting to be in the room where it happens.
Mm. What was he referring to? I didn't have a clue.
Well, he was just saying they're in this room cutting this deal. I'm on the other side of the door. I want to be in the room when these decisions are made.
Mm.
I thought that really touched on something really kind of key about political life, like watching The West Wing, you get that feeling like, you know, there's all these doors with rooms behind them, and you want to be in the one where the decisions are being made.
Yeah.
And they're not always the kind of official meeting rooms.
He had so many great lines as well, because he was full of those sort of home truths at the beginning. His advice to Hamilton very early on was talk less and smile more, which is just great. It kind of made my hair stand on end, you know, kind of think about that in the workplace generally, rabbiting on excusing yourself or apologizing for yourself or whatever, and actually the people who rise up in the workplace are the ones who are just really silent and quiet and self-contained.
And Hamilton never really takes that advice, does he? Because he's like a man of great principle, and he can't stop himself. So even when he has this affair, he ends up writing an entire pamphlet admitting to it, rather than just sort of filing it away.
Some verbal diarrhea,
Yeah,
Burr says to him that every time you put one of your thoughts outside, it's ammunition for someone to use back against you, which is just, it's just amazing.
The Skylar sisters you mentioned briefly, and is it Angelica?
The one he's in love with, but didn't marry.
But didn't marry. The third Skylar sister doesn't really get much to do.
She doesn't come back.
I think she's Peggy. There's a great scene where they're introduced and they're all in these kind of like Disney coloured ball gowns, and they have a great song. But Angelica is immediately pitched as the kind of smartest one, and she's sort of already quoting Thomas Jefferson, and she's got a real, you know, she's got a real Destiny's Child move to her. But she has a great one of the best songs in it. I think Aaron Burr has a couple of fantastic songs, but she has one of the best songs where she replays the scene in which she introduces Hamilton to her sister Eliza, who he goes on to marry, and she replays it imagining what it would have been like if it was her in that position. And it's those moments where, as you say, the musical breadth of the thing is, it could have so easily plodded along on this expository rapping, you know, it's quite easy.
I assumed that was the
opening number,
like,
is actually in that mode, although it's good. The opening number is very much, here's the information in this.
Here's
constant
your history
rhythm.
teacher doing it in a cool way.
But it takes it in all sorts of directions.
I love the idea. When I left the theatre, I was just thinking that there is going to be a whole generation of children in America, and maybe in this country too, and maybe all over the world, who grow up thinking that these founding fathers were mixed race. It's just the way a child's brain works, isn't it? You see that, oh, yeah, he was a black guy. And then their parents go, no, actually Alexander Hamilton wasn't. And it's just that idea of that massive subversion of history in this way that kind of completely ties together on the stage and you don't even think about when you're watching it.
Yeah, so it's majority non-white cast. Yeah. It's a kind of completely multicultural cast. And when Mike Pence came to watch the show, either last year or the year before, I'm not sure, they addressed him at the end. They got up at the end and said, look, you know, we are a multicultural cast. Many of us are immigrants. This is a show about an immigrant. We're very worried about what your administration has in store for us. You know, I hope you've taken, thanks very much for coming, and I hope you've taken something from this evening. And to be fair, I think he actually took it in reasonably good spirits. But of course, Trump tweeted the next day, you know, absolutely disgraceful, harassing Pence, and then tried to start this sort of boycott Hamilton thing, which was completely pointless because the thing sold out, you know, solidly for the next
what
2 years.
What was Pence's job at that point?
He's vice president.
Okay, because there's a great line that says, you know, vice president, we all know that's not a real job, you wonder whether that was literally written in on the night when they saw him on the guest list. One of the other great sort of slogans in it is immigrants get things done.
Yes.
So, yeah. So the idea of his sheer energy and ability to apply himself to the task has something to do with the fact that...
What's the line he has, which is repeated? It's like something like, just like this country, I'm young, scrappy and hungry. He's very much framed as an immigrant figure and celebrated as such.
Were you saying something about like there was a slavery song that was cut out of the eventual?
I mean, there's all sorts of complications about, you know, like any history, they've kind of been very selective. But I thought it was interesting that although slavery is mentioned in passing, it's never really explored. I think having a majority non-white cast makes it kind of difficult for them to do that, to set it up as a big issue. But actually, they did write a rap battle about slavery, and then Miranda just took it out. I guess basically it didn't really fit the narrative arc because none of them were really so committed that they actually wanted to do anything immediate about it. Hamilton was kind of pro-abolition, so he wasn't a fan of slavery, but at the same time, the Schuyler family owned slaves. After the war, he corresponded on the Schuyler's behalf in terms of retrieving lost slaves, purchasing slaves. It wasn't his sort of number one priority. He was also, and you do get hints of this, and I think they could have gone a bit further in exploring some of these slightly darker elements of his personality. He was a relentless social climber. He was a serious kind of supporter of commerce, very hard-nosed. And he was also something which doesn't hugely come out in the show, but which historians have written about. He was a real elitist. So his vision of American democracy was a group of very educated, privileged elite people ruling the masses. He didn't have huge trust for the masses to make great political decisions.
And also he was, you know, they do explore it in this production that he was a philanderer as well.
Yes,
and he liked the ladies. And in a way, I find it odd that the character of Hamilton that you're watching on stage is quite a clear-eyed, sort of noble, innocent figure in a way, even though the actions that he's portraying are political machinations, pragmatism, and all that kind of interesting Machiavellian world. And there's something about the performance itself that sort of didn't quite take in the variety of that character and could have gone, I suppose maybe because you had Burr alongside it, you're looking at the sort of the dark, tortured figure versus the kind of the noble, misunderstood one. But yeah, they could have done more with that, maybe.
It's worth looking up Helen Lewis's piece, which she wrote for us late last year, talking about it really as a play for the Obama era. But it does have a kind of a real resonance now. And, you know, it's kind of slightly heartbreaking when you look back to things like in 2016, Lin-Manuel Miranda did a skit on Saturday Night Live where there's a song in which the refrain is never going to be president now, which is what they sing to Hamilton after this revelation has come out about his infidelities. And it was after all the Trump pussy grabbing stuff came out. And on Saturday Night Live, he like sings to a portrait of Trump, you know, never going to be president now, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, it's...
In Helen's words, it was the Obama musical.
Yeah, sadly the same.
Just afterwards, yeah.
Did not apply.
But also, hopefully it'll put a firecracker up the ass of musical theatre because...
Absolutely,
the problem
yeah.
with musical theatre is that all the music sounds like pastiche and is forgettable.
Yeah.
Whereas this is so slick that, you know, maybe it's going to make people write better and it's not just going to be jukebox musicals from now on, but who knows?
And people have been, you know, there were lots of people there last night, and I think this is quite common, who knew the music. They've been listening to the album for months before they've got to see the show, which is, I can't...
Along with the Reynolds papers.
Yeah, it seems unprecedented to me. But if you can get tickets, beg, borrow, or steal, because it is genuinely an extraordinary piece of work.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So a few months ago, it's before Christmas actually, I started getting emails from the Museum of London, the subject heading of which was simply, Fatberg is coming.
This piqued your interest.
It's piqued my interest. And I kept checking up with them, when's it coming? And they're like, calm down, we don't know, it's coming. This is a portion of the giant congealed mass of fat, effluent, wet wipes, condoms and sanitary products that was found in the sewers of Whitechapel in 2015 and blasted to bits with power hoses. And they brought part of it to the Museum of London. So do you remember the Fatberg story?
I remember reading about it at the time, and I remember that Will Self wrote a column for the New Statesman, classic Will Self territory. I think it coincided with the beginning of the rise of Trump, so he was talking about Trump as a Fatberg politician. It's worth just pointing out the full extent of the Fatberg, which weighed 130 tonnes, the equivalent of 11 double-decker buses, which, as we're just saying, is the industry standard for describing the weight of anything.
It's either space is a football pitch and weight is a bus. They could say, you know, the the weight of the average semi-detached house, but they don't. It's always multiple buses.
But we don't know if the buses are full or not. Anyway, very heavy, stretching over 250 meters. That's 6 meters longer than Tower Bridge. So this was allowed to build up in the sewers until it basically caused a giant blockage. And then the dudes went down there in their hazmat suits and, as you say, their power hoses. And they started working on it with the power hoses. And when they couldn't do any more with the power hoses, they had to deploy small hand pickaxes and shovels and just break it up like that.
So the sewers, the Victorian sewers of London are, you know, your average sort of little brick tunnels. Yeah. But the Fatberg is a depressingly modern phenomenon. This is what really strikes me about this. This is actually the last 10 years. So in our very environmentally conscious age, we have created this very thing. And the main culprit is face wipes. When my drains blocked at my flat, the plumber was like, it's wipes. Stop using the wipes because they're not biodegradable. So most other things do actually go down, like toilet paper. It reminded me of, have you ever been around the Paris sewers?
No, I haven't.
It's really great. There's a trip and you just see this giant concrete ball, like something out of Indiana Jones, that rolls down the tunnels, crushing all the crap in its way.
Oh, wow.
The London sewers look much smaller.
They're tiny. There's a photograph of one of the engineers working on the Fatberg in there. And, you know, he's hunched over in this tiny space. It was 8 or 9 of these guys working 9-hour days for 9 weeks. To remove this thing.
There was a lot of, they were overstating just how toxic this stuff is in the Museum of London. They said it has to be carried in. The thing itself, let's talk about what the thing itself looked like. We built this up way too much.
How did you imagine it before you went to the museum?
A giant gelatinous yellow mass, maybe with a face and teeth or something like that. And actually, what did it look like?
It was a sort of small lump of kind of dirty moon rock in a Tupperware box.
Yeah, and they'd carried it out of the labs in 3 different casings because apparently one whiff of this thing will just kill you stone dead. It looked like sort of crude concrete, but apparently it's very light and it has a very waxy covering. So yeah, they like to. We got some tote bags with Fatberg on, and we got some. What was the other thing in the bag?
Fudge.
Some fudge.
Sludge, branded as sludge. But yeah, you go into this, it's a fascinating little exhibition, but you go into this small room and it's darkened, you know, they've deliberately displayed these, there's 2 separate boxes with chunks of the Fatberg in them, and they've deliberately displayed them as if they are in the British Museum, you know, as if they are some chunk of Tutankhamun's tomb or some, you know.
Excavated Roman burial site.
Yeah, or Inuit reindeer carving or something. But they are just this sort of
the London Inuits.
Small lump of horrible stuff in a Tupperware box. But they are kind of fascinating and you can't really make out the constituent parts of them. One of them has a little double-decker wrapper poking out of it.
Which reminds me actually that the big plan with the Fatberg is to render it down into biodiesel and use it to power London's buses, London's double deckers. So
that's the sort of necessary happy ending that you need for this story.
It's not going to happen because actually we don't know where the rest of the Fatberg is. It's kind of been broken up.
They're working on it.
Maybe it's been sold off in auction houses. Maybe it's on eBay. But you can't have it in your house, obviously, because it smells of, quote, rotting meat with the odour of a smelly toilet.
It's weird to think of all this modern stuff living in the Victorian sewers and the way in which we think of Victorian London as being, like, infected by smog and pollution and kind of a horrifically kind of unenvironmentally friendly place to live. And now, I guess, not only have we got this sort of declining air quality problem, but we're also just growing these giant kind of eco disasters in the ground underneath.
And Victorian effluent was probably fairly easy to manage compared to what we're producing.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're thinking about making these chunks part of the regular permanent exhibition. So no matter what time you next get to the Museum of London, you might be able to see the Berg.
Ryan, thanks very much for coming in again.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
You are first going to tell us how to pronounce the name of the director of Loveless.
I'm just going to take a run at it. I think it's Jagosev.
Jagosev.
Yeah.
Okay. Andrei Jagosev.
You met for us, didn't you?
I did, yeah. When he was over here for the London Film Festival. It was one of the interviews that's through an interpreter, and he's quite kind of taciturn anyway, I think. Man of few words. But yeah, such a powerful director.
And when you were interviewing him, he drew a picture.
Yeah, one of my prized possessions now. It was a landscape. He was just sketching it during the interview. And then all the way through the interview, I was thinking to myself, I'm going to have that. And then I asked him at the end.
So bold.
Because he's one of my favourite directors. So
did he sign it?
He did, yeah.
Wow. Was it good? Or was it just basically like a little doodle?
I can't really see whether it's got any artistic merit. He's such a great filmmaker. That's all I can see. I'd have the napkin that he wiped his mouth on after dinner, you know.
I once had a beer glass that Roger Taylor from Queen had drunk out of on stage, and I got the roadie to pass it down, and it had a little bit of beer in it, and I knocked it back. I wanted to catch a cold from Roger Taylor.
How did I know how that story was going to involve Roger Taylor?
Yeah, unfortunately, I've done it so many times.
But no, Jackie said Roger Taylor. I mean, they're all on the same kind of level.
So I watched The Return and hadn't seen any of his films in between. So this is his sort of, is it third or fourth?
This is his fifth film.
Fifth film,
yeah.
Right.
The Return was 2003. He'd been an actor before in Moscow, stage actor, and done some kind of commercials, I think, as well. And then, yeah, he jacked it all in to be a director and won the Golden Lion at Venice with his first go. And, yeah, I think the film after that, The Banishment, was a bit of a, I think it was kind of second album syndrome, you know, it was a bit of a come down. But since then, they've been excellent. Elena, Leviathan, and now Loveless.
And this is, Loveless is the story of a couple and their son. Maybe you could just briefly tell us.
Yeah, they're going through a very acrimonious divorce, and the son kind of slips through the cracks. I mean, literally and kind of figuratively. They're not really interested in him. They're setting up their new lives with their new partners. And during all this, he goes missing. And that happens very near to the start of the film, about 20 minutes in, and then the rest of the film is about the search for him, kind of what it reveals about the parents. One of I think actually Zagintsev's favourite film is Antonioni's La Ventura, which is about a similar situation. But this is a much, you know, La Ventura is quite a cold film. It's about a girl who goes missing, and the friend she's on holiday with start to look for her, and then gradually by the end of the film they've completely forgotten about her.
Wow.
Whereas this is you know, Antonioni's very kind of stark alienation kind of thing, but this is much more, I think this is a much more distressing film. Mm. I mean, he really puts you through the ringer and puts his characters through the ringer.
He does, and at the same time, I think that it was sustained by the energy of this incredible search and rescue team that you mention is in your piece is actually a real thing.
Yeah,
it's a voluntary organisation.
That's right, Lisa Alert, I think. Lisa Alert. I think it's to do with a girl who went missing with her aunt, I think, in the forest in 2009 or 10 in Russia. And volunteers formed. I think there were kind of celebrations going on at some point at this point in Russia, and there weren't police available to search. They'd all been deployed somewhere else. So volunteers got together, and when they found the girl and her aunt, I was reading, they were dead. But it said if they'd found her a day earlier, they would have rescued.
Wow! So it remained after that, the organisation.
Yeah, that's right. And it's kind of just reading about it in the context of the film, it's completely voluntary, and there isn't a kind of department for missing
persons. The police don't do that.
No, and you see the police in the film. The guy in the film who comes first to the apartment to speak to the mother says you've got a better chance if you get in touch with these volunteers.
One of the moments to me that just showed how this chilling lack of panic on the part of the parents once they realise he's gone missing is when they are searching, the father's searching with this team, and he just gestures towards the river and says, "What about in there?"
Yeah.
And what father would actually suggest to
I know,
that their child might be under the water rather than
that
alive?
That sense of detachment and not really... Don't you feel with the father that he is really kind of dulled in a way?
Yeah.
He's kind of almost anaesthetised. I mean, the mum, for all her faults, she does leap into action. And the father's just saying, oh, he'll turn up, you know, at first. Mm. And she's the one who kind of, you know, I mean, she's constantly on her mobile phone, and she says several times in the film she never wanted the kid in the first place. But she is kind of motivated and kind of energized by the search for him. No, I don't think it's kind of black and white about the parents, which is what I liked. At first I thought, God, what awful parents. But then there's things in it like the mother suddenly kind of leaping into action and the father knowing all his son's online passwords, which so he can't be completely detached.
Whereas
from
the mother, when asked by the search rescue guy, you know, what's he into? She says, oh, nothing. He just sits at home, I think. And the guy goes, you think? You know, it just shows how little you can know your own kids.
Yeah, he's disappeared.
If you're not paying attention.
Exactly, he's disappeared long before he's actually disappeared.
Yeah. But how symbolic is it? Because, you know, that's sort of my rudimentary knowledge of Russian filmmaking, I feel that Russian directors are known for making comments about the country itself in the form of symbolism in the films. And, you know, you suggest in your piece that this boy is essentially a sort of sacrifice You've got the whole idea of Mother Russia and all that kind of
thing. Yeah, we should say that Jaggins have shot down my idea that he was a Christ figure.
He said, let's not.
He did a bit. Let's not go in that direction, he said. But yeah, I think there's definitely, there's a scene towards the end of the film where we see the mother jogging on a treadmill and she's wearing a tracksuit that says Russia on it. And so she's on this treadmill going nowhere slowly, basically, which sounds obvious when you say it. I mean, it works in the film, I think. There does just seem to be a sense of, I don't know if it's about Russia specifically or kind of the modern world generally, where we're so involved with kind of technology and things like that. That's the baldest kind of thing in the film, isn't it? Everybody's on their phones, everybody's taking selfies.
It's striking, isn't it? I haven't seen many films where phone use is so accurately deployed. Like, it really is, you know, it's the last thing she does before she goes to bed at night, the first thing she does in the morning. And that's the case even before she's kind of locked into the whole search and rescue mission, you know. And that's modern life, but, you know, for various reasons films don't particularly want to engage with it.
Well, plus it's not very cinematic, exactly, someone looking at their phone. Yeah. But yeah, there's a scene, isn't there, where she looks at his photo kind of almost tenderly on the phone. It's like, well, you never looked at him like that in real life.
Yeah.
She can only kind of interpret it through the phone.
I mean, I was sort of getting the message from it at one point that it's saying, you know, the sort of the authorities, the schools, the rescue team, they are superficial and they are caring for this child, where the parents are self-absorbed and fully digitalized and westernized and just completely wrapped up in themselves. But then you think about, actually, there is no police force really searching for him. It's almost about the triumph of kind of maybe community over individual when it comes down to it. He is cared for. They are searching around the clock for him, and it's his parents who are very selfish and self-absorbed are kind of dragged into that rather than forging ahead with it, aren't they?
Yeah, I think that's where the hope in the film comes from, that through uniting, I mean, again, you risk making it sound kind of banal, but in the kind of unifying action of looking for the boy, there is this kind of humanity emerges from the society we see, as harsh as it is. The phones are interesting in the film, because there's also, they tie in for me with this idea of family, the image of family being more important than the reality. So people taking photos of experiences are more important than the experiences themselves. Because do you remember the dad in the film is so worried? His big worry is that his boss will find out he's getting divorced.
Yeah.
And that, you know, they're a very Orthodox Christian, kind of very upright, kind of right-wing company he works for, and it's all about the family. And he gets told a story about a colleague who possibly hired a woman and children to accompany him to a staff do.
Yeah.
Agents.
Yeah, so his big thing, and I'm not even sure if the dad in the film, I'm not even sure if he's told his new girlfriend that he's got a son.
Because he doesn't explain that he's looking, does he?
Yeah, she phones him while he's with the police.
Yeah.
And she says, put me on speakerphone. So, yeah. Do you remember? It's quite chilling, hints.
In the little flashes of news reports and everything, and what you were just saying about the company being a company that would frown upon an employee who was divorced, I wondered if there was a bit of a sort of dystopian twist to the Russia that he's painting there. I mean, there's a report at the end talking about lots of people in the Ukraine now live underground, and you know, people may be driven to suicide by the current goings on, and it felt like almost like a 28 days later kind of Eccleston broadcast.
That's right. As they're searching, they get into more and more dilapidated premises. There's that great kind of tumble down building at the end that they're searching, which
looks like a school, doesn't it?
Yeah, which is just completely derelict and everything. And there're also radio broadcasts. You're right about that sense of kind of dread. There's radio broadcasts about apocalyptic fervor. Do you remember about the Mayan calendar?
Because it's 2012, isn't it?
That's right, because it's set in 2012.
Yeah, so that's real rather than the kind of twisted future.
Yeah,
that's
so this sense of kind of creeping dread through society.
The way it's shot as well adds a whole another layer to this, in that you get these kind of beautifully framed images of the bare trees, snow.
He loves his trees.
He loves his trees.
That's why he was drawing them.
The drawing was trees, yeah.
You get this kind of incredible focus on specific details that, because there's a slight kind of mystery thriller element to the plot, you can't help sort of start looking at them and thinking, is he trying to give us a clue here? So you'll get a real slow zoom onto the very gnarly roots of a tree. There's a sequence where the boy throws a piece of police tape up over a branch. Then there's a very, very odd little 5-second sequence when we're going into a restaurant where we suddenly get see things from the point of view of a random man who we haven't met.
We don't even see his face.
Trying to pick up an escort.
Isn't that strange, that bit?
I love those. They're all quite sort of disorientating. And I guess on a very simple level, they just make you look closer at the images you're in front of you.
It's like the film is teaching you, like saying, pay attention.
Yeah. Slightly Hanukkah-ish almost. Yeah. You know, you've got a big building. Which door is it that's going to open out of this mass of windows and doors?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's kind of training you to pay closer attention. I mean, it's interesting you mention Hanukkah because I feel like Hanukkah does this sort of stuff quite cruelly, like Happy End, his most recent film, that has a lot of mobile phone stuff in it. And you said, okay, it's the fall of civilization. We're all on our phones. Whereas with Shag and Sev, it seems to be about more than that. He's kind of shown us what we could have. Yeah, real sadness.
Yeah, a dislodgement or something rather than a kind of deceitfulness coming out.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And I think casting is really important here. The two kids that were in his first film, The Return, their faces are so distinctive. They're like these kind of bashed in potato. And the boy in this, who you see at the beginning of the film, his face is so, it just stays with you. So like throughout the film, even when they're searching for him.
It's amazing to have that central character be such a blank, you know, we're never told much about him. We don't really get to know him. There's two images in the film, which will stay with me forever. One is...
Don't say them. Don't say them. This is my bugbear because so many critics have given away a particular shot in this film, and Jagan Sef himself and his producer were just livid about it because they banned that shot from being in the trailer.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah,
I wonder which one it is. I can't remember.
An insight into the film reviewers.
Yeah, I'll tell you when we're off air.
Great.
I remember you saying something about this, but Ryan Gilbey is the sort of equivalent of the search and rescue mission, but just hunting down spoilers, eliminating them. But it's actually he's like the guys in the hazmat suit. We just went to see the Fatberg in the Museum of London this morning, and Ryan dons his hazmat suit.
I just feel like
eliminate spoilers.
I feel in my job I'm lucky enough to see stuff before anything, usually before anything's been written about it.
And
as much as possible I want to preserve that for the reader. Or there's a particular shot in the film, and I saw it in the London Film Festival this, and went back afterwards and read the Cannes reviews and was just horrified that pretty much every critic gave away this.
Wow. When we're off air, you've got to tell us which one it is.
Yeah. And it is, it's brilliant. I mean, it's a brilliant piece of filmmaking, but you have to kind of not know it's coming, really.
But what's brilliant about the way he deals with the child is that with so little, we feel so much for him, I guess. And this is up for an Oscar, I think.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what the competition is like for the foreign...
It's very strong competition. I've only seen one of the other films in competition, which is A Fantastic Woman. It's called a Chilean film, really brilliant, which I'll be reviewing in the magazine next month, about a transgender woman who's persecuted by her lover's family. It's really fantastic, almost Almodovar-esque. And there's another film in competition, The Square, which is from the director of Force Majeure. And that won the Palme d'Or at Cannes last year, so where Loveless won the Grand Jury Prize.
So it's pretty good.
Pretty stiff competition, yeah. I can't remember the other two films, but...
Are you going to be watching the Oscars overnight?
I might do, actually. Yeah, I haven't done it for years. But
March 4th, right?
Yeah, we'll see. I'm usually lucky if I can make it to the end of Newsnight, so we'll see.
My friends watched it at an Oscar party last year, but they'd all fallen asleep just before the envelope.
Thing.
So they were texting each other saying, "It's the most boring Oscars of my life. Oscar's so boring." And then that happened. And yeah, I was actually in America and I could have watched it in real time, but I was too bored to watch it in real time. So, but thank you very much. So Loveless is out already. Isn't
now
it?
I think or tomorrow this week.
Anyway. Yeah, a Friday near you. Now it is time for our non-iversary section, which, as we all know by now, is the non-specific cultural event of a certain number of years ago.
Specific?
Oh, it's specific in terms of its timing.
It's just insignificant.
Maybe it's not specific in our minds. Oh, no, you're right.
It's got very clear parameters, this
technically
lot.
Technically, it is
a specific event,
thing.
But of limited cultural significance and probably not a sort of journalistically significant date
in the mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this week we have another listener submission. So thank you to Peter Selby for pointing out that it's been 32 years since Zamo Maguire went heroin on Grange Hill, precipitating the amazing Just Say No campaign, which I remember as a child, a song, a charity song, which they did that was a bit like Feed the World, where all the children came off the show having had no vocal training whatsoever and held their headphones and sang into the microphones about the importance of you don't have to be part of the crowd, just be who you are and stand up proud.
The video is amazing because they're totally replicating everything you see from those kind of charity videos at the time. Why did everyone hold their headphones like that?
Maybe
was headphone technology so poor that the kind of volume and leakage, you know, no one had Bose headphones,
possibly.
So they all had to just ram them into their
ears. It's also a way of making the very boring paraphernalia of the studio look slightly more interesting,
yes, that's
isn't it?
True.
It's like in the folk clubs, Ewan McColl used to press his ear in with his hand to sing because he's not doing anything else. That's something to look at. So Ryan, do you remember the Just Say No campaign?
I do. I'm exactly the right age. I think if it was 32 years ago, yeah. Then yeah, I was 14. So I think the year before that, it must have been on Grange Hill, that storyline. There was I remember such a skillful piece of misdirection because you knew when that particular series started that there was going to be a drug storyline. Someone was going to be addicted to drugs. And there was a new kid in the school called Danny who was very shifty looking. And everybody was like, oh my God, it's going to be him. It's going to be him. Rather than Zamo, who we'd known all along.
Yeah.
That was such a brilliant bit of misdirection. I remember just the conversations at school the next day. We were all just so
did you shocked. Buy the single?
I didn't, unfortunately. I mean, I bought plenty of terrible 7-inch singles, usually novelty records, but that wasn't among them.
So what happened in the actual storyline? Is it one character sort of slowly getting embroiled in? It's heroin,
over
right?
Over two it's seasons. Like, yeah. Two series, yeah.
Yeah, I'm surprised to hear it was two seasons. I guess everything's telescoped in your memory. My memory is that it was just a sudden reveal that it was Zamo, but you know, he must have been showing signs all along that you know, I just didn't pick up on it.
Antisocial.
Yeah. Yeah.
I find it really frightening because what's 32 years ago? I'm no good at maths. What is it, like 1986?
Yeah, 86.
So I was like five and I remember this storyline, didn't watch Grange Hill. It was that collision of adult scary thing and children's setting.
Grange
that
Hill was
really
always
freaked me out.
Yeah, at that age it must have done. Grange Hill was always it was the program that our parents didn't like us watching because we were going to learn words we didn't know or bad behavior or something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe I just went to a particularly good school. We were all well behaved. But yeah, so parents didn't like, so that added an extra layer of danger, the fact that it was going to be about drugs. I mean, people were already smoking in it and kind of mildly swearing.
And Anthony Minghella wrote the script, didn't he,
I know.
For a long time.
Isn't that great? Yeah, he worked on a lot of TV stuff. He worked on a lot of Inspector Morse as well and various things like that. Yeah, I'm not surprised. It was, I mean, my memory is it was great writing. I don't know what it'd look like now.
So, because Grange Hill went through a few different sort of iterations, didn't it? And I think this was possibly the beginning of the kind of issues-based storylines which sort of by the 90s, they were really, you know, just writing to issues.
The bleakness.
Yeah.
Now, didn't you discover a strange coincidence with the date as well?
Oh, yes. So, 8th. So, today, is it the 8th today? It is the 8th today. So, it's actually 40 years since the very first episode.
Yeah.
Which is 78.
And 32 years this month since the heroin.
40 years since the sausage was thrown across the dinner hall on a fork.
Or as Peter pointed out, the it put children off heroin until 10 years later when Trainspotting came along. So thank you, Peter, for that. And please keep them coming, the non-anniversaries. We like to hear your ideas.
Thank you for downloading this episode of The Back Half. Thank you to Ryan Gilby for coming on, and do look up his interview with the director of Loveless, which ran in the New Statesman a couple of weeks ago. Also worth checking out Helen Lewis's piece on Hamilton, which we talked about earlier. Kate, is there anything else we need to say? Rate us on iTunes, get in touch on Twitter.
And as ever, we will be playing you out with the smooth tones of Pistol Jazz with their song Godspeed.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.